Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and we're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 3rd of February. Our main stories. The WHO says there's no need for travel restrictions to stop the coronavirus, as China accuses the US of spreading panic. After Brexit, the EU and Britain set out opposing visions for their future relationship. And Turkey attacks Syria after six of its personnel are killed there. Also in the podcast, seven children in need of critical care are flown out of Yemen, the first Mercy flight in more than 3 years. And the British government responds to the latest terror attack in London.
I stress the importance of the custodial option. And that's why I've come to the end of my patience with the idea of automatic early release.
The head of the World Health Organization has again said there is no need to close borders as a result of the coronavirus outbreak in China. The Chinese Foreign Ministry had earlier accused the US of creating fear by imposing excessive restrictions. The virus has now killed more than 360 people, triggering a sharp fall in shares as China's financial markets reopened after the Lunar New Year holiday. The latest from our China correspondent, Robin Brandt.
China's central bank had tried to preempt any big sell-off with a big injection of cash and a message of calm. But investors sold pretty much across the board. The equivalent of more than £300 billion was wiped off the value of China's top companies. It's clear there is now a significant pessimism about the impact that this virus will have on China's economy. The government said the US was partly to blame for what it called spreading panic, by banning visitors from mainland China, although other countries have done the same. But as Beijing turned on America, the authorities in Hong Kong, part of China, announced further measures to try to stop the spread of this new type of coronavirus there, closing more access points and hoping to further restrict the numbers coming in from the mainland.
Robin Brandt in Shanghai. The European Union says it's offering Britain a highly ambitious free trade agreement following the UK's departure from the organisation, if it meets certain conditions. However, the UK has already rejected the European demands. The chief EU negotiator, Michel Barnier, told a news conference in Brussels that Brexit filled him with sadness, but now was the time to look to the future.
On Friday last week at midnight, the United Kingdom left the European Union. It was a sombre moment, also a very emotional moment. But it's also an opportunity for a new start, for a new relationship.
We'll hear more on the British response in a moment. First, what have we learned about the EU's position? A question for Adam Fleming in Brussels.
We actually haven't learned a huge amount more about the EU's position in these upcoming talks with the UK, because this document unveiled today is very much based on the political declaration that was signed and agreed with the UK and the EU as part of the Brexit deal last year. Remember, the political declaration was that much shorter document that sketched out the shape of the future relationship. This is basically, on the EU side, a procedural step to turn that document into a set of negotiating objectives that are then instructions for Michel Barnier, the chief negotiator, who will then embark on the negotiations with the UK. Although I thought it was interesting that Barnier and the officials that worked for him kept on stressing the idea that there were no surprises here and that this was based on the political declaration. That is reflecting a little bit of frustration in Brussels over the last few days at briefings and statements from British government ministers which had suggested or accused the EU of going back on its word. So they didn't say it directly, but I think they were a little bit annoyed at some of the language coming from the UK.
Yeah, there is frustration too here in Britain. I noticed that the Prime Minister's spokesman has said the political declaration is clear that the UK is seeking a Canada-style deal. And the criticism here is that the EU is demanding more from the UK than it did of Canada. How does the EU respond to that?
Well, Michel Barnier addressed that by saying, well, look, the free trade agreements that the EU has with other international partners are all unique. Each country gets a tailored thing. So Canada's free trade agreement is different from the one that South Korea got, which is different from the one that Japan got. And the reason the UK is being asked to sign up to conditions that some people in the UK think are more onerous is because it's a bigger economy, it's closer to the EU, and it's already very well connected. So that is why the EU is saying the UK has got to sign up to some conditions to make sure there's a level playing field, or what the EU calls fair and open competition between the two sides.
Shortly after Michel Barnier spoke, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson took to the stage in Greenwich, the heart of maritime London, to outline his vision, rejecting calls to sign up to EU regulations, as I heard from our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
So the British argument is for Mr. Johnson, hey, look, you know, we're not planning to be Singapore on Thames. We're not planning to completely undercut the European Union. So, hey, we don't need to share the same rules. Our standards are going to be just as good as yours. We don't need new institutions. We don't need new mechanisms. We don't need new treaties. So in other words, long story short, they're a very long way apart, the EU and the UK.
So what happens now then? Both sides go into talks, they argue across each other, and then eventually there's some compromise?
Well, who knows? I mean, it seems to me that it comes down to this question, and that is, to what extent will the EU recognise what the UK is asking for, which is essentially could be called equivalence. I mean, there are two ways of trading with another country or with another bloc. You either align with them, you accept the same rules dynamically, as it's called, or you kind of agree with them, hey, look, you know, we live next door, you know us well, our rules are going to be just as good as yours, but different maybe. And I mean, at this point, we don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think the EU is clearly very, very concerned that sort of basically having to take it on faith that the UK is going to be a good neighbour is not good enough. And then I think if things get nasty, clearly the EU would seem to have more clout than the UK, in the sense that, you know, their market is bigger for the UK than the UK is for them.
Yeah, I mean, Boris Johnson and others have been talking about possible border checks, possible tariffs, preparing the ground for, I guess, a possible no deal. They're talking about this either Canada option or Australia option, but are we heading to some kind of no deal?
I think that's perfectly possible if the European Union doesn't recognise equivalence, or if, unless, of course, the UK moves a bit more the other way and decides it will align. I mean, here's the thing that it seems to me is that the Brexit revolution continues in Johnson's rhetoric. I mean, he's talking about Brexit as, you know, this is not continuity. Britain is going to look and feel different in its relationship with the EU. And in that sense, it seems to me he is totally betting on the farm, and the government's own forecast suggests it's an immensely foolish bet that somehow there definitely will be less trade with the EU, but that it will be made up with by trade with the rest of the world and his promotion of global free trade. As I say, the government's own forecast suggests that's not the case, and that there's no way global free trade could make up for any diminution in trade with our nearest neighbour.
Rob Watson in London. We also heard from Adam Fleming in Brussels. Six Turkish military personnel killed by Syrian government forces. 30 to 35 Syrian troops killed in response. That is the reported outcome of an incident in Idlib, the last remaining province in Syria held by rebel forces. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkish forces would always respond to any assault.
Turkey has retaliated and continues to retaliate with full force to this attack, as we did with previous attacks. Designated targets are being hit by artillery fire and F-16 fighter jets. We are determined to continue our operations that we conduct for the safety of our country.
Turkey has 12 observation posts in that part of Syria under an agreement with Russia, and said it had coordinated with Syrian forces. So what exactly happened? Jonathan Marcus is our diplomatic correspondent.
That's still unclear. It does look as though there have been exchanges of fire between Turkish forces and Syrian government troops. The Turks are making it very clear that they are responding to an attack against their positions. It also looks as though the Turks have been trying to reinforce their observation posts, very small bases in the Idlib province, and they say they coordinated this with the Syrian authorities. Apparently they didn't coordinate it well enough. But I think what's underlying this is that the end game, the last battle, if you like, for Idlib is underway. The Syrian government forces, backed up by the Russians politically and crucially backed up with Russian air power as well, have been making significant gains. And the Turks really don't see this as something that is in their security interests. And so that rather tangled and difficult tripartite relationship involving Ankara, Damascus and Moscow risks, I think, unravelling.
So are the Turks defending the rebels in Idlib? And if they are, isn't this kind of event inevitable?
Well, I think it is probably inevitable. This is a very strange tripartite relationship. Remember, not so long ago, before President Assad was, as it were, confirmed in power by the intervention of Russian air power and Iranian-backed forces on the ground, the Turkish government was one of the strongest countries that was trying to see President Assad's demise. It liberally funded and armed groups to try and pursue its strategic interests in Syria. Its strategic interests, in a nutshell, are a desire to make sure that the Kurds don't emerge with too much autonomy, because that, they fear, would influence Kurds inside Turkey's own borders. And, of course, the disruption in Syria has prompted a huge wave of refugees coming into Turkey across the border, many of whom the Turks would like to resettle back in Syria, in the border areas closer to them. And so this final offensive, if one wants to call it that, by the Syrian government forces is prompting both a huge wave of refugees, but also seems, as far as the Turks are concerned, to be breaching the agreements that they made with both Ankara and Moscow.
Jonathan Marcus. For the first time in more than 3 years, a UN flight carrying civilians needing medical treatment has left the Yemeni capital Sana'a, which is under Houthi rebel control. Reports indicated that 30 critically ill patients, mostly children and their carers, would be on the plane. Around 30,000 people need treatment abroad. Civilian flights out of Sana'a have been blocked by the Saudi-led military coalition. From Yemen, here's our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette.
It's a warm winter's day here in Sana'a. That's the sound of air hockey. It could be any park, but there's a difference. Most of these children are critically ill, and most of all, Ragged. She's a thin 13-year-old with a protective face mask.
Ragged is a very smart student. My daughter is the first student in her class.
Ragged's father, Abdullah, speaks proudly of his smart daughter. There's something he doesn't want her to know. She's waited so long for a flight, her body is now full of cancer.
I didn't want to tell her, because if she knows, maybe something, everything will be changed for her. If she stays in Yemen, as the doctor said, both legs will be amputated.
Amputated?
Amputated, yes.
This is the only cancer hospital in Yemen. And now we're going into the cancer ward for the children. And inside this room, in little beds, four little boys, their hair lost from chemotherapy, wearing woolen hats. Ali pulls his hat down over his eyes. One of them is bulging and white.
My name is Dr. Abdullah Thawaba, National Oncology Center in Sana'a.
What would have caused Ali to lose his eye like this?
Ali is diagnosed a case of retinoblastoma in the eye, tumor in the eye, caused blindness for this eye.
But if this little boy was able to leave the country, he could get a new eye.
Yeah, if this patient is cured after treatment, after he completes his treatment, he needs artificial eye.
So Sana'a Airport has been closed to commercial flights for 3 years now.
Sultana Begum of the Norwegian Refugee Council in Sana'a.
What this amounts to is a death sentence for thousands of sick Yemeni civilians who have been unable to get out of the country for urgent medical care. There has been the use of blockade, which has prevented food, fuel and medicines coming into the country. This means that the health system is barely functioning.
The cemetery in Sana'a. Gravestone after gravestone, a cemetery as big as 5 or 6 football pitches or more. And today amongst them, 17-year-old Awab. He has a story about a war which shut an airport and caused his father's death.
He had cirrhosis of the liver. He was able to get medicine normally in Sana'a. But after the blockade began, the medicine disappeared. We couldn't find it. If the airport had been open, we would have been able to travel. This war has destroyed everything. Many patients have died, just like my father.
Awab, ending that report from Yemen by Lise Doucette. And still to come in this podcast,
The case that can never get out of my mind is this 8-month-old who came highly dehydrated. And lo and behold, within 2 hours, we lost the child.
How ritual tooth extraction is causing deaths in Kenya. Plus, could committed Republicans soon be in government on both sides of the Irish border? For the second time in just over 2 months, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has promised to stop the early release of convicted terrorists. On Sunday, two people were stabbed by a man who'd been freed around a week ago after serving half his sentence. Sudesh Aman was shot dead in South London by a police officer. In December, Mr. Johnson had promised tough new laws to deal with convicted terrorists being released early after an Islamist extremist on licence from prison killed two people near London Bridge. Today, the Prime Minister said attempts to stop reoffending had failed.
De-radicalising people is a very, very difficult thing to do. There's a big psychological barrier that people find it hard to get back over. And that's why I stress the importance of the custodial option. And that's why I've come to the end of my patience with the idea of automatic early release.
But will that end the attacks? I spoke to our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera, who first told me the man involved in Sunday's incident was being followed by police at the time.
This is, in some ways, an unusual case because the individual was under active armed surveillance by undercover officers. And he appears to have got hold of a knife in a shop and then begun to attack people and within seconds was shot dead by those officers. In a sense, it could have been much worse if those armed officers hadn't been there and able to intervene so quickly. But of course, raises the question, why was he under surveillance and such close surveillance? Why was he such a risk? He'd been released a week ago from prison after serving half of his sentence, which is the standard procedure now, and that's one of the issues. But with that in mind, clearly he was judged a risk based on why he'd been locked up initially, and also it's thought his behaviour in prison made him a high risk priority for the security service, MI5 and the police, and so they put this armed team on him, which was able to act. But clearly there is a question then about his release, and the problem for them was there were few other options because that was the procedure, that was the way it had to operate, and so their only option then was to put this surveillance team on him to keep track of him.
After the last incident, just before Christmas, the government said it was going to do something about this early release and try and stop it. Obviously, laws take time to come through. But even if he'd been released at the end of his sentence, he wouldn't necessarily have been de-radicalised.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the challenges to it. They have proposed some legislation to extend the sentences, to toughen up the licence conditions. Some of that you can see may have some impact, but if you have an individual who is determined to commit violence, even if you put them through a de-radicalisation scheme in prison, it may not work. They may come out committed still to try and carry out an act of violence, and it requires having this kind of surveillance on them. So it is quite a complicated policy challenge. I mean, there are ways people talk about, can you look for other offences they might have committed in prison? Are there other ways of creating longer sentences for them to keep them in longer? But there is also the policy challenge that you've got a group who have been convicted in the last 10, 15 years who will be coming out under an existing legislation. It's quite hard to make changes retroactive to cover those people. So I think there is a lot of questioning about what actually can be done about those cases, people who've already been released or about to be released, as well as what new laws can be put in place in the future to try and deal with this problem.
Our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera. On Saturday, the Republic of Ireland will hold one of the most unpredictable elections for years. Sinn Féin, once known as the political wing of the IRA, is polling on a par with the two mainstream parties that have governed the Republic for a century, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. The current Prime Minister, or Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, is struggling, despite his apparent success in the recent Brexit negotiations. My colleague Dan Damon spoke to Mary Minahan, the assistant news editor at the Irish Times.
It's proving a very difficult campaign for the outgoing government, which is led by Fine Gael and Leo Varadkar. They've been in power for 9 years. So there's a definite sense, polls are saying, that people want change. So in terms of where they go, you have two parties now neck and neck offering change. And one, as you say, is Sinn Féin. The former leader, Gerry Adams, has retired there. And a new female leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, has taken over. And I suppose she deserves some of the credit credit for the surge the party is seeing. And then neck and neck with Sinn Féin in the polls is the Fianna Fáil party, which used to dominate politics in the Republic of Ireland, but was kicked out mercilessly by the electorate during the financial crash in 2011. But really the key things that people are focusing on are the housing crisis and also the healthcare crisis in Ireland. I think those are the two key things that are worrying the electorate as they go to vote on Saturday.
And you didn't mention Brexit, Mary, and yet that does offer a real dark shadow, doesn't it, over whatever happens to the Republic of Ireland?
I think this has been a big surprise for the outgoing government because it put Brexit front and centre of its election campaign, because the Fine Gael party led by Leo Varadkar is very proud of how it has handled Brexit and how Ireland behaved throughout the whole negotiations and dealings with Boris Johnson and so on. But it hasn't really registered with people who are just looking, I think, more at local issues and social issues and so on as they go to the polls. And I think the reason for that is there was cross-party support for the government's stance on Brexit. It wasn't a divisive issue because the vast majority of people in Ireland, they don't think Brexit was a good idea. They think it will affect them badly, but they all think that together, if you know what I mean. So nobody is arguing with the government on right. that particular topic. So I think it was a mistake for them to major on that.
What happens, and this is speculative because it's a very proportional election. It takes, I think, several days to get all the results out. What happens if Sinn Féin does do very well? What does that mean for the border and relations north and south?
Ireland has had coalitions now for generations. So whatever happens, we'll be looking at some form of coalition. Sinn Féin is running 42 candidates across 39 constituencies. To get a majority government in the Irish Parliament, you need to reach that magic number of 80. So obviously, there's no chance of Sinn Féin getting that far, although it is riding high in the polls at the moment. So I think what we might need to be looking at is some sort of confidence and supply arrangement, or other smaller parties propping up a Sinn Féin-led minority government, or a minority government led by one of the other major parties that I've mentioned. Another party I think it's important to mention in this election, Dan, is the Green Party, because obviously you have this green wave sweeping around the world of politics. So a lot of people will be watching that party.
Mary Minahan, Assistant News Editor of the Irish Times. There have been protests and widespread disruption in Nigeria following a controversial ban on motorcycle and tricycle taxis in Lagos. The authorities say the ban in Nigeria's biggest city is needed to tackle accidents and criminality. Our Nigeria correspondent Mayeni Jones reports.
There were long queues and anger from many Lagosians on their way to work on Monday morning. Dozens of drivers of commercial motorcycles and tricycles also took to the streets to protest what they say is the unfair targeting of their livelihoods. Last week, the Lagos state government announced it was banning the use of commercial motorcycles, known as okadas, and tricycles called kekes, across 15 areas of Lagos and 40 bridges from the 1st of February. It blamed what it described as scary casualty figures, as well as growing rates of crime connected to these modes of transport. The state governor ordered the deployment of 65 buses along major routes to make up for the shortfall in public transport options. But the decision has been met with widespread condemnation, with commuters complaining that the contingency plans were insufficient to meet the needs of Nigeria's most populous city.
Mayeni Jones reporting. Ritual practices of baby tooth extraction are still widely practiced in parts of Kenya, causing deaths and injuries. It's common among the Maasai and Turkana communities in the belief that removing milk teeth treats childhood illnesses. But there is growing concern from health workers because it exposes the children to risks such as viral transmission, profuse bleeding, anemia and septicemia. In Turkana in northern Kenya, the health authorities say it's a major contributor to the infant mortality rate. The BBC's Mercy Juma is there and warning some listeners may find her report distressing.
Under a huge acacia tree with barely any leaves to provide shelter, an elderly woman sits. She sharpens a set of nails on a stone. They call her the village doctor. Although she has no medical training for 3 decades, Esther Eregai has been pulling out teeth from babies and toddlers.
I have done this for a long time. I took after my mother. They come here when they are very weak, some even fainting. I use these nails and they get better.
Traditional child tooth extraction is deeply entrenched in the Turkana culture. This community blames the canine tooth that is just emerging for causing diarrhea, fevers, and delayed development in babies. Today, Esther's client is Emily Lele. She says her 10-month-old daughter has had diarrhea for 4 consecutive days. She thinks a problematic tooth is to blame.
I have brought her here so that the teeth can be removed. She was disturbing me. She is having diarrhea every time. So I have brought her to this mama. I am used to doing this, even for the older children. I brought them and the diarrhea stopped after extraction. And no, she has not eaten anything bad. I know what it is, and I am sure the diarrhea will stop once the teeth are removed.
Emily's daughter kicks and fights as she is held down. The so-called village doctor, using a sharpened nail, forcefully removes 4 teeth from the wailing baby. This is normal practice here, but it is rarely, if ever, done safely. I am in the children's ward at the Lodwar County Hospital. A huge percentage of the children who've had the traditional procedure and here with severe infections and deformities. The hospital says traditional tooth extraction is responsible for a quarter of new admissions. Dr. Gilchrist Lokowell is the Turkana County Director of Medical Services.
The case that can never get out of my mind is this 8-month-old who came highly dehydrated and running fevers of 40. And lo and behold, within 2 hours, we lost the child.
In an attempt to tame the practice, the local government and local hospitals have come up with outreach programs to educate the community. They use community health volunteers to spread information on the dangers of traditional tooth extraction and the importance of taking their children to hospital. Meanwhile, Esther Eregai sits under the acacia tree, collects her $3 for every child brought to her, and sharpens her nails as she waits for her next customer.
That report from Kenya by Mercy Juma. Celebrity marriages are irresistible for fans and the media alike, and so too are breakups. That's especially true if they happen quickly, as was the case with ex-Baywatch star Pamela Anderson, as Riley Carlson reports.
Love and marriage, love and marriage.
Less than 2 weeks after saying I do, Pamela Anderson told The Hollywood Reporter she and her fifth husband, producer John Peters, are taking a break. The two wed at the end of January in a private ceremony in Malibu, but haven't finalized the marriage paperwork yet. They're asking for privacy. If they decide to split, they'll land somewhere in the middle of the list of shortest celebrity marriages. Not quite as long as, say, actor Renee Zellweger and singer Kenny Chesney, who married in 2005 but reportedly split just 4 months later, or Jennifer Lopez and backup dancer Chris Judd, who lasted 9 months.
I married for love.
It's also not as long as reality star Kim Kardashian and Chris Humphries, who had a lavish and televised wedding, but divorced after just 72 days. Miss Kardashian defended the wedding on Australian TV.
Anyone that would, you know, get married for a TV show, it's just, you know, ridiculous, and it's just sad that I even have to defend that. I guess that's the kind of scrutiny you get when you live your life on a reality show.
But it is much longer, about 5 times longer, than Britney Spears and Jason Allen Alexander, who wed in Vegas but only lasted 55 hours.
Love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage.
That report by Riley Carlson. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
The Compass is the BBC World Service podcast that explores big ideas.
We have a tendency in science, when we talk about the intelligence of animals, to go for things that we are good at. So we are good at language. If you have a talking ape, people are extremely impressed, or a talking parrot for that matter. But other skills we don't care much about.
And how those big ideas shape the world around us.
Animals are more or less a symbol of an economic system that has a dead end, that it's all focused on production and consumption. Animals are suffering and we do not take care of each other anymore.
The Compass Podcast from the BBC World Service.
She's an intelligent, social, autonomous being. She needs her freedom.
Search for The Compass wherever you get your podcasts.